his fingers, singing my life with his words.
Thank you for tuning in to The Queer Truth, the podcast that takes on a variety of topics from pop culture to everyday life. I'm Chantel C. You can call me Cece, and I'm joined by my partner in organizing, Denise.
Hey!
Denise, it's been so long.
I know. Who are you? Where are you? Where do you live at? What's your name is?
Happy to be back.
Good. I'm happy that you're back as well.
And happy to not have recorded the last few weeks with the things going on in the world.
Ooh. Yeah. I mean, could you imagine? I think it would have just kind of like devolved into a primal scream. We would have been on some old, like, let's go into the cave now. We need to be reborn.
Yeah. I mean, I listened to some really good podcasts, for example, Code Switch, and they were breaking things down, and they had one of my favorite professors on there, Dr. Anderson from Emory University. She's like, you know, full chair of African American studies there. People were speaking the truth. I was really surprised by that. So that was encouraging, but I was thinking, I'm actually glad we're not on the podcast right now, because that would mostly just be in my feeling.
There's room for that, though. there's room for that. We need to, I think it gets lost, you know, what is happening when all of this violence, rhetorical violence and actual violence is happening, about what the effect of that trauma is, or even we don't even have time to even recognize sometimes that it is trauma. So I would have been here for you being in your feelings.
Well, today I'm in my feelings, but in a positive way, because yet again, it was time for Black Girls Rock. For those of you who've been following us for a while, we talked about Black Girls Rock last year. This year, I was even more enthusiastic about it. It's in its 11th year, founded by the celebrity DJ and former model Beverly Bond. For me, it's hard to like say Beverly Bond. Like, I always feel like I have to say DJ Beverly Bond. But anyway, she launched Black Girls Rock in 2006. And she's still the executive director. And she, you know, this was taped already on August 5th, but it didn't air until August 22nd. But she had a theme of love. She wanted to honor people who are doing things in the name of love, which I found really timely. And you know, she's from New York City. She loves activism, entertainment, business, education. And Black Girls Rock does a lot of different things. This particular episode was aired on BET, and it took place in the auditorium of the New Jersey Performing Arts Center. It was amazing. If you watched it, or if you have not watched it, take some time to watch it. One of the highlights, right when the award show was about to start, was Representative Maxine Waters was sitting down already, and Dionne Warwick came in, and Rep Waters had to stand up, and they went, gave each other a very warm hug. Now, when I saw that moment, I did ask, I wonder what Aretha thinks about that.
Oh, shut up.
Is Aretha going to come out in 5 years?
Hey, Aretha, going to be on, nah.
She's going to come out in 5 years talking about Dionne was all up on Representative Waters, and she know that's my chick. That's my chick. But, you know, it could happen. But a lot of people were honored on the evening. Who shall we start with? Let's start with Issa Rae.
Issa Rae. Oh, great minds think alike.
Issa Rae was honored, given the Star Power Award, and she gave a really cute speech that she had in her hand, by the way. She had written it down, her points. She did not read from a teleprompter. No shade to those who do. And she just told a story about being young and the three times that she had kind of a realization while she was still in middle school. The time she realized she wouldn't be the funniest, the time she realized she wouldn't be the coolest, and the time she realized she wouldn't be the prettiest. What do you think about her acceptance speech?
Yeah, she's so real. I think she was able to fill out kind of a niche in representation where no one else, I can't point to another media figure that was doing what she started out doing. There's so many aspects of Black womanhood that haven't been explored. It's not that that's the only one. It's just that she was able to provide that with an authentic voice, did it well, so enjoyable. And now, you know, I mean, just very real. I just love her. I think she's amazing.
Do you feel like The Misadventures of an Awkward Black Girl is the same?
Revolutionary? Yes. Yes.
Do you feel like Insecure is a continuation of that, or do you feel like it's something new?
No, I think she's a different character on Insecure.
Okay.
So, I, you know, she's grown to sexy on Insecure. She's still got some awkwardness to
her. Quite a bit of awkwardness.
Yeah, she has some awkwardness to her on Insecure, but it is not the highlight or the distinctive characteristics of her character. Not to me. You know, I mean, I think that is framed more in this sense of trying to figure it out, making bad decisions.
Lots.
As opposed to like, I'm awkward, haha, right?
Okay, I
like,
see what you mean.
She's not angling that nerd lovability that she was in Awkward Black Girl. That's a totally different thing.
Watching.
And then also it was like Awkward Black Girl was more of like a slapstick, sitcom-y, funny type show than Insecure is.
Yeah. Watching this week's episode, I just enjoyed it so much because I felt like what she does amazingly well, and she does write a lot of these episodes herself. What she does amazingly well is little dialogue saying so much because she's speaking in our language. Like, there's no desire on Insecure to translate for those people who don't get the beats and the culture.
Right, right. Which is also really good about what Atlanta does, right?
Right.
Is that it's showing what Black writers could do that nobody else could do. Mm-hmm. Is that they can speak in their own voice instead of having white writers write in what they think a Black voice is, which is usually horrible. So now all the actors have to do is actually act something that is authentic as opposed to try to bring life to something that is completely improbable.
Right.
Like, you got it, Miss Daisy. I mean, like, it's really awesome to see the acting on Insecure. And absolutely. So I'm just so happy that she exists and that she came to those realizations and that she is ambitious and like just on top of it as she has been. Mm-hmm. And that I'm just so happy to see her shine.
Absolutely.
Big fan.
Also, Solange was presented with the Living Legend Award, with the award by Beverly Bond herself. Solange, just to recap, Solange gave us this speech of, it was just like the most Solange speech ever. She was like, I was always searching for my place and I still am. And I want young girls to know that that is a part of the journey. And you don't have to be this, that, or the other. You don't have to try to make yourself fit in somewhere. And she hopes that that people looking at her will recognize that and that they'll also recognize that she doesn't have it all figured out. But what she does know now is that she can just be without trying to make it work for other people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, Bay fan, what do you think about Solange's speech?
Oh, I'm a big Solange fan too. So just in case you thought it was either or, it's and.
Oh, I know it's
and.
Not, I know it's not either or.
I mean, she's so odd, but that's great. You know, I mean, she's breaking boundaries, but it seems effortless. Like, she just performed at the Guggenheim.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seemed like such a natural thing for her to do, as opposed to like, oh, Solange is trying so hard, you know?
Right.
She's just like, okay, what do I want to do? And then she does it. And that comes through in her work. So yeah, that's mad inspirational. And that archival piece of her album, I think, was super important.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a huge part of what made that album work and what makes Solange work is this clear understanding of that she exists in this continuum.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, love Solange.
And then, not to be forgotten, Living Legend Award was also given to Roberta Flack. Roberta Flack is so gorgeous. And so, just as soon as she came on the stage, I just got chills because I love Roberta Flack and her music is a lot about love. Another reason that she was honored. And she made jokes, you know, even while reading her speech from her notes. And I just felt like this particular show, this iteration of it, did such a good job of the generations represented across the board, because we don't want to forget Representative Maxine Waters, who won the Social Humanitarian Award.
Yes, yes.
And what did she say? She said, you know, if it were left to the alt-right and the white supremacists and others, she may think something different of herself. But because of the Black women in the room and the Black women who support her and uphold her, she said, quote, but now I know I'm simply a strong Black woman. And that was so great to hear because, you know, in the work that I do, I hear women say all the time, oh, I was called confrontational. I was called aggressive. And I say, who said it? Who said it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Who said that?
Oh, well, you know, some man. Uh-huh. What kind of man? Mm-hmm. So to have Representative Waters stand on the stage and say she, too, would be vulnerable to these comments.
Oh, you never escape it. The president, the first lady didn't escape it. I mean, it's you just never escape it. There's no point at which, like, you break free and people are like, oh, that's, you know, that's just a person. Mm-hmm. Right. And if ever they see you as not those things that they think of as stereotypically Black, then they try to, instead of saying, wow, maybe these stereotypes are trash, they say, well, you're not really Black. Right. Like that's how that goes down. So the fact that she does this so wonderfully and she speaks also because, you know, I mean, everybody sees auntie in her. Everybody knows someone in their family that is the Maxine Waters of the family, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so there's something about her that is so relatable and so loving, but yet so firm. I'm so glad that she occupies the space that she occupies. History is going to be interesting in how it looks back on a Maxine Waters, right? Because you have Black women right now being some of the strongest voices against the current nonsense that is happening, mm-hmm. right? So the fact that they're holding it down on this level for a country that hasn't necessarily held it down for them is very telling.
Indeed. And but, I feel like what's beautiful about
but her not is, all of, mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say what I think is really great about her story currently is she is here to experience the positivity and the support in a way that I feel like maybe Shirley Chisholm didn't get. She got it later, but not necessarily while she was doing it. Whereas, you know, at least on a monthly basis, something that Maxine Waters is doing is going viral, like reclaiming my time. You can't, that's set in stone now. You will never be able to replace
songs.
It. We got songs.
Now it's in the church. It's in the church now. it's him 205 at this point. Oh, man. I'm reclaiming. Yes. Good. But not all Black women, right? Not all Black women. Not Stacey Dash.
No. Not all Black women. But I feel like we've been real clear that we're not, like, you can't lose your Blackness, but you can lose your Black card. And Stacey Dash, she didn't lose it. She, like, returned it. She said, I tried out the subscription. And
she asked for a refund.
That it's not for me. Stacey Dash had the nerve to call Representative Waters a buffoon because she said, if you're coming for me, know that I'm coming for you. But the irony of it is Stacey Dash is actually the buffoon. So why did she even feel the need to comment? Nobody was asking her any questions. This was something that she felt the need to comment on all on her own.
Right. I mean, like, look, The Root came out with this article that was very, very timely called about Charles Barkley and the idea that you could be a Black white supremacist.
Yeah.
That there are some Black people out there that just really just hold true to this idea of whiteness in the sense of anything white people do is okay, appropriate, excusable, you name it. And if we can just be as white as possible, we aight. Right? So that was mighty white of Stacey Dash, but, you know, she still ain't got no job, so.
There you go.
There you go. Even after being cast away, the fact that she has not been able to, like, wake up from this slumber, this was deep. This one was deep all the way in there.
Damon, come get your cousin.
Is Damon cousin?
Yes.
Oh, nah, she can't come to the cookout.
You didn't know that was Damon's cousin. You don't remember when Gabrielle.
But Damon Dash is super ignorant.
But he's grown. He has grown a little bit. Look, I've met Damon. He is, like, back in the day, 10, 12 years ago, Damon, even longer than that. I can't remember when it was. Damon was super ignorant, but he trying to do better today. He building empires now after losing them. And honestly, he's never said anything like Stacey has said when it comes
to Oh, no. He hasn't, as far as I know. But it wouldn't also, I mean, like, his, it wouldn't surprise me, is what I'm saying. Surprise me. I just feel like, you know, this, yeah, that's a whole wow. Damon, oh man. Yeah. You know, hey. Stacey, do you.
Mm. Well, there was also the Young Gifted and Black Award that this year went to Yara Shahidi, who I love. I'm a huge Blackish fan. OMG, am I. Last year, it went to Amanda Stenberg. This year, to Yara Shahidi. She gave a beautiful acceptance speech, which felt like spoken word. I don't know that everybody was ready for it. Some people were like trying to keep up. Maybe not everybody is used to spoken word, but the speech was on point, and you could see that she was overwhelmed with emotion, and her TV father, Anthony Anderson, presented it to her. Side note, other than two award recipients, which were the Mad Girls Award recipients, Ibtihaj Muhammad, Habn Gemma, and Augusta Uwamanzuinana, and Solange, who was presented the award by Beverly Bond. This year was the first year that all awards were presented by men. So Maxwell presented the award to Roberta. Yeah, I think so. Because, you know, it is called Black, or the theme was Black Love is Revolutionary. And I guess the point was to say, you know, Black men need to step up and give their voices and give their appreciation and give their recognition to Black women who do so much. Maxwell presented the award to Roberta Flack. Issa Rae received her award from Jay Ellis. That was cute. She's like, I wouldn't cheat on you in person, you know, in real life.
It would have been cute if he was like, let's find out. I just feel like if I could just like be a comeback writer, like just write comebacks for people.
I think you would be really good at it. Another side note, I took this little stupid quiz to see what insecure character I would be, and it said I would be Daniel, and I wasn't mad about it. Anywho, yeah, I think because in the theme of Black Love is Revolutionary, she wanted to make a statement about Black men as well. Who knows? I don't know. I can't speak for Beverly, but that's kind of my interpretation of it. You're not feeling it?
I like it. I mean,
real convincing.
But yeah, Black male representation is cool. That's awesome. I mean, but there's something about that. Like you said, Black love is revolutionary. And if it's about that per se, Black love isn't always between a man and a woman.
No.
But other than that, yeah, I guess. I'm lukewarm on it.
So in today's second segment, I have the opportunity to speak with Imani Robinson. Hi, Imani.
Hi.
Could you tell our listeners a little bit about what it is you actually do?
Yeah. So, hi, Cece. It's nice to be here. I am Imani, and I'm an organizer and a writer, and I'm part of a collective called Sorry You Feel Uncomfortable, who are kind of radical arts space made up of different artists and makers and thinkers and DJs and filmmakers who kind of create conversations or spaces to have dialogue around the things that are kind of pervasive in our everyday lives, sort of including but not limited to anti-Blackness and the ways in which that kind of informs our art practice and our thoughts and ways that we relate to each other. My community organizing at the moment is mainly with UK Black Lives Matter, but generally it's around sort of anti-racist, queer-centered, feminist practice in the UK.
So what would you say your current focus is when it comes to activism? What are the things that you're giving a lot of attention to specifically?
Well, personally, at the moment, my main attention is about reflecting on what I think my sort of best contribution to the movement is, and I've started to sort of write morning pages on it and also just kind of critically but also lovingly be aware of like the impact or lack thereof that my kind of organizing is having, because organizing takes a lot of energy, right? And it's also something that I don't really feel like will ever not be something that I'm doing in the world, or something that I'm sort of dedicating my life to. And so I'm at the moment in a quite a reflective space of, like, you know, there's so much going on in the world, and there's so much of a feeling of urgency. And I'm trying to, I guess, translate that feeling of urgency into something more productive and less straining, because I think for Black people and for people who are organizing against oppression and gratuitous violence in our lives and in the lives of our families, you know, that sense of urgency never really goes away. But in the same way that sort of Audre Lorde speaks about kind of uses of anger, a kind of sense of urgency can just be very stressful and very anxiety inducing and lead to, like, feelings of despair and, you know, really put you in a place that means that you're always, like, on a defense or on a kind of, yeah, really high intensity state of mind, basically. And so I'm trying to figure out what those uses are, which means that I can use that sense of urgency, the anger that I have, and the kind of the kind of tendency to want to react immediately to sustain me, rather than to be something that kind of, that just eats away.
As a U.S. American, when I tried to talk about race in London specifically, but in the U.K. or in Great Britain more generally, people hear my accent and find that good enough to reject anything that I say, because I'm American and I don't know anything about it here, and racism doesn't exist here, and if it does, not in the same way. Are you confronted with similar statements, and how do you go about confronting them?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a really common thing to be, you know, like with BLM, for example, in the UK, you know, we're asked, so BLM started, or BLM is a kind of US project, and obviously, you know, there's a lot of work that has gone into building that US project, but it's also always in relationship to the rest of the world, and when we get asked things like, you know, isn't it worse in the US? First of all, you know, it's not worse to the parents of the children who have been murdered by the police in the UK, of which there are many, and disproportionately they are Black. It's not worse to sort of, you know, the mother who has to live in temporary housing, who is Black, who is kind of shipped around the UK, trying to find safe and affordable housing, and, you know, treated like a leech from the state rather than, you know, any sort of human being. And so I kind of bring it back to, like, the individual experiences of people in the UK who are experiencing a systemic and systematic racism throughout their lives. I'm also, you know, struck with that question of, like, it doesn't make anybody feel better to think about something worse happening somewhere else.
And it also
distracts from the project of actually looking at the country that we are in, the situation that we are in, and analysing exactly what is going on. You know, the UK has never not been a racist, anti-Black, oppressive country. You know, even in its formation as, you know, a nation, it's sort of inherently exclusionary, inherently oppressive, and built on the backs of Black and brown people, you know. And so, yeah, so I always kind of, you know, at first kind of feel a sense of let's have this conversation, but then very quickly, you know, if the person that's asking that question doesn't listen to what I'm saying, you know, it's like, I'm not the first person, this is not the first generation to make the very clear point that there is racism in the UK, and that, you know, it's not something to argue about or something to ponder over or something to even have a conversation about. It's like, there has been enough evidence, kind of qualitative and quantitative, you know, that kind of makes that question really redundant, or that sort of conversation really a waste of everybody's time. It's not about me proving to you that racism exists, because if you can't see it in the UK, then you're probably benefiting from it.
Where would you say it's, well, from a standpoint of a sense of urgency, what would you say are the top priorities right now when it comes to the systems or institutions where Black people are most faced with issues of racism in the UK or in London specifically?
So I think, you know, at various times there's, you know, specific governments and specific policies that can be kind of organized around, or there are specific situations that can be commented on, and there are specific direct actions around, you know, a death or a change in law or something like that. But I think that the three, or, you know, the things that I always have to come back to is that is, you know, we can predict that there will be, I could spend my life trying to influence or change specific policies in specific sectors, and working in sort of parliamentary politics in the sense of trying to organize around getting a party into power that can, you know, pose as somebody or a party that is, you know, really about human rights for everybody. But there's nothing and no one and no time in which that has ever achieved full enough the kinds of liberation that Black people deserve and need. And so the kind of the things that I'm always thinking about are, you know, one, find your people. So figure out, like, you know, what your best contribution to the movement, you know, how much energy you have to fight or to resist or to survive or to do more than that, and find others who kind of share that that sense of urgency, but also that kind of commitment to showing up for each other. And this is the kind of for us, by us type thing that's kind of, you know, getting some light at the moment, but that is actually one of the main tenets of community organizing, is what do we have that we can share with each other and amplify and create some sort of meaningful, sustainable change that is actually, that means the power remains within us, rather than sort of appealing to the state or the institution or the whiteness, but really about kind of, yeah, more deeply understanding the ways in which we can survive, and the ways in which we can create those conditions to, you know, bring in something different. A second thing is kind of, you know, you can't work on anything without a kind of fullness of integrity. And integrity is not something I think that you have and that stays with you and is unchangeable, or that doesn't evolve. It's something that you work on every day and that shifts. And that really comes through being accountable to others, in a way that's not like, you tell me what to do, but in a way that it's like, I'm committed to getting through this with you. You know what I mean? So an example of that is like, organizing across difference. But not just, like, when I say find your people, I don't mean find the people who are exactly like you. I mean find the people with whom you can grow and evolve and learn the most, but also who can learn lots from you too, because everybody has something in their experience, and many things in their experience actually, that that can really bolster and hold communities together. But it's about doing that with humility, and that doesn't mean, you know, not having a light shine in you. That means shining your brightest light and having that encourage others around you to do the same. And the third thing I think as well is, I guess it goes back to this humility thing as well, in the sense that, you know, if you look at people like Angela Davis, for example, and I know I'm using a US sort of person, but there are lots of other examples that I could give of people outside of the US who kind of share the same principle, and lots of people I know in my own life who kind of have this understanding that the work is a sort of lifetime thing and a journey, and not something that can be that will come to a conclusion in your lifetime. And so that kind of orients you to always doing things that will follow through, like, after you've gone. So, and I bring up Angela Davis because, you know, she's one of those elders who you don't actually situate in a time that's gone, but you situate in the everyday, in the now, and somebody who reads themselves against themselves and grows and you know, is very willing to show up in ways that they didn't know that they could, but they're committed to before.
You said, you know, Black liberation will not be reached through policy change, but when you think about things like Grenfell, the Grenfell Tower burning, the reasons that it burned, and the work that was done before that, and the statement that they made, you know, they don't believe any change will happen until there's a great loss of life, which is basically what happened in the end. Is it, I would say it's important to be working from both angles, in the sense that we're working toward policy change, working from within a system that's broken, as well as working from the outside of a system in hopes of completely, you know, taking it down and rebuilding something better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I don't think that the changes that we need will be made in the afterlife of Grenfell. I also know that, you know, there will be situations like Grenfell every day, and so, you know, yes, there were specific policies that were put into place or not put into place which allowed for this fire to happen, but, you know, before Grenfell Tower was burning, there were still so many things involved in the situation of their lives that, you know, that were not pointing to Black liberation, that were a kind of you know, visceral example of a people who were forgotten by the state, but also, you know, the state was never built to remember them, or to remember them as human beings, and as worth sort of fighting for, making any changes for, you know, in a very base sense, valuing. And so, you know, policy change and whoever's in government changes, you know, specific things for specific people at specific times, but policy is never something that will maintain or be sustainable, because it can always be revoked or written over, or there are loopholes, you know. And so it's not really about changing policy as a liberatory kind of project. Changing policy is very important for many many different reasons and many different people, you know, in healthcare and housing and education, there is a model that, you know, liberatory minds and community organizers have built and built again and tried to put into action, right? And it would save a lot of lives, and it would, you know, in a very real sense, create the conditions for people to thrive and survive. But, you know, if the state gave us everything we wanted, anti-blackness would still be pervasive, because the state itself, you know, is part and parcel of the problem. And so, you know, it's not about dropping all other tenets and sort of revolutionary transformative rupture, but it is about acknowledging the limits to any sort of policy change, any sort of asking the government for anything, you know. And I was speaking yesterday about the example of domestic violence, and thinking about, you know, all of the policy changes and changes in law and safety nets and structures that can come about through the state to do with domestic violence and to do with the safety of women in particular, but of people of all genders who are at risk of domestic violence or intimate partner violence or gratuitous violence on their bodies, right? And, you know, domestic violence is something that can be fought against through the state to a certain extent, you know, creating safe spaces for women who are fleeing, or, you know, making it easier for people to escape their situations. But, you know, from a kind of sort of feminist abolition perspective, you know, it's also deeply kind of unfinished to kind of ask that, you know, the penalties for engaging in such violence are kind of imprisonment or to do with the carceral state. It's also, you know, there's something deeply amiss if you're wanting to fight domestic violence, but you can't speak about things like patriarchy in a kind of way that doesn't include the state, in a kind of way that refocuses the conversation and the project onto how we relate to each other, onto consent, onto what it means to respect people's boundaries and be held accountable for the way that we are taught to exist and taught to relate to each other. You know, gender identities, masculinity, patriarchy, misogyny, these are all things that will exist if we leave them alone, no matter what we say or do in the state.
So just one last question.
Mm-hmm.
So we have listeners in Vienna, in London, in the US.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something that unites the activism and the journey towards liberation in, on the continent?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think definitely. I think there always has been and there always will be. I think we have varying capacities to be in relationship with each other on a kind of person-to-person level, partly due to language, partly due to resources, partly due to time. But I think that to, you know, since sort of the advent of transatlantic slavery, for example, but before that as well, you know, to think about my experience as a queer black woman in London as one that is severed from anybody else's experience, regardless of gender or orientation or even colour, really, you know, is to miss some sort of crucial point, which is that, you know, we all are infinitely connected to each other, and organizing at different levels is reflecting that. But we also have so much to learn from each other about what difference that difference is actually making. Because there are also problems to believing that, you know, there's a difference between saying our lives are intimately connected and our struggles, therefore, are as well, and so the solutions have to be two. And saying it's the same in the US as it is in the UK, as it is in France, as it is in Spain, as it is in wherever, as it is on the continent, you know, of Africa, not Europe. And so, you know, so I guess what I'm saying is, like, there are so many opportunities to be in a sort of relationship that is one of, like, mutual understanding, mutual benefit, mutual evolution, mutual learning, that is not kind of repeating some of the same mistakes, because, you know, I speak English and that's the only language I speak, which means there's a whole, you know, gulf of understanding and of access to ways of being in the world that were formed and created by Black people in different places. There's also situations of the US, like, historically telling everybody else in the world about this race problem, and actually facilitating this idea that the US is the place that racism happens and everywhere else is just sort of an unfortunate similarity, or something that is kind of like that but much worse in the US, you know? So it's really about expanding our understanding of what it means to say, to use the word self and to think about your own life, to that being really a kind of generative relationship with the rest of the world and people around the world.
Thank you so much, Imani. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you.
Extremely enlightening. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cece.
In our final segment, what are we excited about? What's making us happy?
Girl, so in the end, let me just lay out very quickly what queerness looks like in Vienna, because there's been a lot of talk about racism within the queer community here as of late. And it's similar to the queer community in Berlin that we were both a part of, but less edgy, right? But there still seems to be this sort of, I always run out of words when we're on the podcast. I was going to say exaltation. I turn into a preacher. Okay. But definitely this, in terms of priority, there's definitely this sense that, you know, femme women are devalued. There's definitely the sense that androgyn women are devalued. Trans people are still used for comic relief, and even in queer production sometimes, right? So there's a lot going on in the queer scene here to combat this and to come together and try to fight this. And in the midst of this, an organization has emerged called Visibility, by Visibility Organization here in Vienna. They have organized, they are formal, and they are launching in September. Oh. So, yeah. So that's exciting. I'm excited about that. What are you excited about, Miss Cece?
Girl.
Uh-oh.
I don't even know where to begin. This weekend is going to be lit. So tonight at the Tate Modern, they have a thing that they call the Tate Lates. Tonight from 6 to 10 p.m., they will be showing Solange Knowles' Ferguson 70 States. There will be music programming by all the big DJs. There will be a little area for drawing Black superheroes. There will be a place for writing Black power, that will be led by one of my favorite spoken word artists who's local, Bridget Minimore. She's dope. Then there's going to be an area called Keeping It Real, inspired by the Soul of a Nation exhibition that's on right now at Tate Modern. Not to speak that I can go into that exhibition tonight for free because the Tate Late is free. And it's based on Soul of a Nation. Then they're going to have these like on loop commissioned films by four artists in response to the Soul of a Nation exhibition, one of whom is Cecile Emeke. And then I get to watch Sampa's film, Shy Light Launch. Boom, boom. Okay. Be jealous. Okay. Be jealous.
Actually, I'm not jealous because I just looked at fares to go to London.
You gonna get here by six.
Yo, EasyJet is doing the most. I might could do it. Brussels Airlines? What? What you talking about, Brussels? It could happen. Nah, I'm not gonna come.
And then it's bank holiday weekend here, which means it's the end of August. It's bank holiday. You know what that means? Notting Hill Carnival. The second largest carnival celebrated in the entire world.
That's going to be so great.
There's been all kinds of nonsense in the run-up to it because the police talking about they want to use facial recognition
software.
Even though everybody in tech knows that that software don't work on Black folks because tech got all the unconscious bias of the white.
What I would like to see is some resistance to that by, like, you know, it's really easy to make face masks, and it's also really
easy. I was thinking about
to make too. Like just do face coloring where you just put like white spots on your face, and then it's completely trashed.
Which is why Cece might have on some glitter because I'm not trying to have no face recognition. But I have to go because it's an important year to go and support it. The people of the community have asked for us to come out because of the Grenfell fire. They want us there in large numbers. We gotta represent. Further, Stormzy, who I didn't even know was woke like that, but
oh, my baby daddy.
I had to catch up. Stormzy.
Oh, you didn't know that was my baby daddy? You didn't know?
Goodness. Yes. Stormzy came. So there's a Twitter account for the Metropolitan Police, and they had the nerve to tweet some nonsense about all like a kilo of uncut heroin that they found in Catford, which is an hour away from where Carnival will be, talking about in the run-up to Carnival.
They're like, we found this in Wales. Clearly, it has something to do with Nottingham Carl. Like, this is how deep the reach is of the criminal activity. Right. All right, go on.
So I'm just like, you know what? I'm going to Carnival in protest. And then on the Monday, there's going to be a special stage dedicated to Fela Kuti. It's the 20th anniversary. And his son will be there, Femi Kuti. It'll be my second time to get to see Femi Kuti perform. So, yeah, this weekend, I'm already a bit overwhelmed by it. I hope I don't wind up in bed with the covers over my head. But I'm going to try to do the best I can and support all these amazing projects for the love of Black people. Well, that's all for this week. If you would like to keep up with us, you can follow us on Twitter at The Queer Truth. We'd love to hear your thoughts on some of the things we've discussed today, so feel free to get at us. And please support us on Patreon, patreon.com/thequeertruth, so that we can keep going in 2018. Until next time, peace out.